Hey everyone, One here. Before we go on with today's podcast, I have two very important things to tell you. The first one, it's to thank you again for your kindness, your words of encouragement, and for listening to what I have to say. The second thing that I need to tell you is the most important one. On behalf of myself and my family, our hearts go to all of you who are experiencing hardships right now. Whether it be the fires on the West Coast, sick relatives or friends, COVID, or otherwise. Do know that we have those things in mind and that we, as many of you are, we're doing our part to help people out. Please remember that even though I will not allude to these things in the proper podcast, they are in my mind, as I know they're in yours. Basically, what I want to do is that for the next 45 minutes or so, help you forget about those sad things, to entertain you for a little bit, and to entertain myself as well. Alright? So, let's begin with today's adventure.
This is the Bald Scientist Podcast, where we talk about science, from the factual to the fictional, and sometimes a bit of both, with the good doctor, One R. Pagan.
Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 2 of the Bald Scientist Podcast. I am, of course, your host and ear candy, One. Thank you once again for joining me and for all your kind words and encouragement. Before we go on with today's episode, I'd like to spend a few minutes of our time talking about something that I've been asked a few times already. Where does my name come from? You know, you already know that it's spelled like just like the number one, O-N-E, with a little accent over the E. Ever since I moved to the mainland, I've been called a lot of things. Oni, One, and of course, One. But you already know that it's pronounced One. So, where did One come from? Well, it came from my late father. My dad's name was Onesimus. His parents took the name from the Bible. I think it's of Greek origin, but we're Puerto Rican. Go figure. Anyway, his nickname was One. I was his firstborn, so one thing proverbially led to another, and here I am, yours truly. It gets worse. My last name is Pagan. It also has a little accent over the second A. But if you read it without the accents, of course, you will call me One Pagan. It goes without saying that I'm having a lot of fun with my name. And in fact, I have 3 Twitter friends who call me Professor One. They are Yasha, Renu, and Eloisa. I love it. It's endearing, it's cute, and I wouldn't have it any other way. Please never stop calling me Professor One. Also, I have yet another Twitter friend, her name's Jen, who calls me Professor Worm. I love it too. So, to the 4 of you, a very special hello. Hello. Well, since we have already established how to say my name correctly, and by the way, just don't call me Heisenberg, okay? What? You don't know what I'm talking about? Look up a little TV show called Breaking Bad. You can thank me later. For now, let's talk some science. I am sure you remember that I finished episode 1 with a poem about science and wonder. You see, it is no secret that a lot of people think that science, creativity, and art are incompatible. That is simply not true. And in fact, I have a few surprises for you in that regard. I have 2, perhaps 3 future guests lined up for future episodes who will disprove for us the misconception that the arts and the sciences do not mix. But for now, I would like to read the poem for you again, so we can begin our conversation about science and wonder. This poem was written in 1867 by the famous writer Walt Whitman. Here it goes. When I heard the learned astronomer, when the proofs, the figures, were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and diagrams to add, divide, and measure them, when I, sitting, heard the astronomer where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon, unaccountable, I became tired and sick, till rising and gliding out, I wandered off by myself in the mystical moist night air, and from time to time looked up in perfect silence at the stars. As you can imagine, one of the main points of this short piece of poetry is to emphasize on the importance of wisdom and contemplation as opposed to mere knowledge. You can also imagine that I disagree with that, and you would be right. But I will not be the first science-minded person who thinks so. For example, Isaac Asimov was a very famous science fiction writer. He was also a chemistry PhD. And he actually argued that scientific knowledge and wonder do not have to be mutually exclusive. He was not the first scientist to actually argue so, but certainly he was the most eloquent, as it were. He put it in writing in an essay in the Washington Post, Science and the Sense of Wonder, which was published in 1979. And by the way, please remember that I will post links to the relevant articles and resources in the show notes. But let's continue. In the article, Asimov argues forcefully but in a lyrical way about how science can enhance the sense of wonder. You can read how he explains how science can inform wisdom, but for now I'm going to try to illustrate more or less the same idea by illustrating how inadequate our brains are when we're trying to visualize, to come up with a really good idea of really big numbers and really small numbers. For example, let's say that you're watching the news and they talk about, I don't know, the economic status of the world, of our country, and they talk about billions of dollars, trillions of dollars. And sometimes we get used to people throwing out those really big numbers, but we really are not equipped to actually visualize how big those numbers really are. Okay, let me give you an example. Let's suppose that just for fun, I asked you to count to 1 billion with a B, as in bold scientist. Okay? So every time that I use an example like this in class, usually, not every time, but usually, there's always a student who says, well, a billion seconds. But that doesn't help us at all. So let me express the idea of a billion with a B, as in bold scientist, in a slightly different way. What if I tell you that to count from 1 to 1 billion nonstop, 24 hours a day, okay, 7 days a week, it will take us about 32 years and change. 32 years and change. Okay, let's begin. 1, 2, 3. So if you had $1 billion, it will take 32 years and change for you to count it all. All right? Now that we have a better idea of how really big a billion is, we can use it to try to visualize certain aspects of the majesty of nature. For example, did you know that in our galaxy, the Milky Way, there's between 100 and 400 billion stars? Did you know that the Milky Way is only one of trillions of galaxies in the observable universe? And by the way, a trillion with a T, as in Tommy, is 1,000 billion. So if we want to count from 1 to 1 trillion, again, one number per second, 24/7, nonstop, it will take us, again, about 32,000 years and change. All right? Numbers like this can give us an idea of how big the universe really, truly is. But here's the thing. We cannot really get a reliable idea of how big the universe really is by just going out in a clear night and look at the stars. You see, in a clear night, we can observe just with the naked eye up to maybe 3,000 stars, give or take. Nowadays, it's even less due to light pollution and, you know, phenomena like that, but I digress. It was only with the invention of a certain contraption called the telescope, invented by one of the undeniable giants of science, Galileo Galilei, who was born in Pisa, Italy in 1564 that people learned that there were many, and I mean many, more stars in the skies above us than the mere 3,000 or so that we can observe just with our eyes. Remember a while ago when I mentioned the Milky Way? That name was in use even before we knew that the tiny points of light that we observed in the sky at night were stars just like our own sun. When our ancestors were looking up at the sky at night, in addition to the stars and planets, they saw this whitish patch of sky without any resolution into stars whatsoever. And they named that white patch of sky the Milky Way. One fine day, well, actually I should say one fine night, Galileo was testing his telescope, and it occurred to him to actually train it on the Milky Way. And pretty soon it was very evident to him that the Milky Way was not a solid object at all. It was composed of thousands upon thousands of stars, too small to be visualized with the naked eye. I don't know what the equivalent of holy crap is in Italian, but I'm pretty sure that Galileo said something like that. You see, Galileo was a really facetious character, but that's a story for some other time. At any rate, I hope you agree with me that it was only through the development of technology based on scientific ideas that we were able to truly begin to gain an inkling of understanding of how really majestic our universe is in astronomical terms. And don't get me wrong, I'm one of those people who actually go outside at night and likes looking at the stars. But the thing is that in addition to the beauty that I can observe by looking at the heavens at night on a clear night, I have a deeper understanding of how things are. For example, my favorite constellation is Orion. And it's my favorite constellation because the mighty hunter and protector always reminds me of my dad. I admire the beauty of the stars, no question about it. But thanks to science, I know much more, many more details than add to the majesty of it. For example, each of those stars, the brighter stars, and even the nebula that's located near its belt, they are located at various distances from the Earth. For example, one of the stars can be located 700 light years away from us, and yet another can be located, I don't know, 200 light years away from us. Furthermore, one of its stars, Betelgeuse, made the news recently because it started to diminish its brightness, and people began speculating that it would go supernova. Alas, that didn't happen. As of tonight, let's see what happens, well, in the future. The main point is that without science, we wouldn't know those additional details. Again, science and wonder can and do go hand in hand. Just in the same way that science and technology allowed us to discover many wonderful things about the big structures of the universe, science and technology also allowed us to discover a lot of very interesting things at the very small scale of things. Up until the 1600s, we weren't even aware that there were forms of life too small to be observed with the naked eye. That had to wait until the invention of the microscope. In the late 1500s, a family of lens makers, the Jansens, came up with the idea of putting a couple of lenses in front of each other, and, well, the first microscope was born. The funny thing is that the Jansens microscope doesn't even look like the typical microscope that we are used to nowadays. If anything, it looks like a small telescope. But historically, it was the first one, so here we are. The Jansens microscope was little more than a glorified magnifying glass. It was only able to increase the apparent magnification of an object from 3 to 9 times at most. We had to wait until the 1600s for a true microscope to be invented. This was the invention of a gentleman called Anthony van Leeuwenhoek, who was not actually a scientist. He was a merchant. He used to trade in linens and clothes and whatnot. And he actually wanted to find out a way to determine the quality of his merchandise as determined by the number of threads in the actual linen. So he invented the first true microscope, capable of increasing the apparent magnification of an object to about 200 times or so. It didn't look like an actual microscope at all. Rather, it looked like a little base with a highly polished sphere of glass attached to it. And by putting the object that he wanted to observe very close to the glass sphere, he would be able to see a significantly enlarged image of the object. Pretty soon he started putting whatever he could get his hands on under his microscope. He was actually the very first human being who actually observed microorganisms. He would put a small drop of water under his microscope, and he was able to see all the millions upon millions of microorganisms in it, like protozoans, bacteria, you know, amoebas, things like that. He actually called them little animals because he saw them swimming like crazy in the water. He also observed certain types of bacteria for the first time using a
trigger alert,
not very clean method. He would scrape the gunk off his teeth in the morning and put the scrapings under his microscope. I know, disgusting. I told you, that's why I gave you the trigger alert. Moreover, he was the very first person in history, in the history of science, who observed sperm cells. And no, I am not telling you how he got his samples for those particular series of observations. Look it up. That tone indicates that it's time to move on to the next topic. What is biological life? This is kind of a tricky concept because it has been notoriously difficult to define over the centuries, millennia even. There's no clear-cut, universally accepted definition of biological life that satisfies everyone. In other words, the phenomenon of life defies a single, clear-cut, one-sentence definition. And the best thing we can do at the current state of knowledge is to recognize living beings by what they do, instead of by what they actually are. The crux of the matter is the following. What distinguishes living things from non-living things? Let me give you an illustration of how daunting this problem is. We know more, way more, about what happens at the very core of a star than what happens at the very core of a cell. Think about it. No human has ever been at the very center of a star, and yet we have physical theories, physical ideas that actually explain very well what occurs within a star. On the other hand, cells are right here. We are made out of cells, and we don't really understand completely, at least, the workings of a cell. The cells are, in other words, the closest thing to a veritable black box in biology. Here's another example to illustrate how little we know about biology. We have a very good idea of what happened at the very beginning of the universe, at the birth of the universe. The phenomenon that we call the Big Bang happened about 14.8 billion years ago. And again, we have a very good idea of what happened then. However, we don't know as much about what happens exactly at the moment of conception in sexual reproduction. You know, when a mommy and a daddy love each other very much.
If you don't know what I'm talking about, talk to a responsible adult.
But let's continue. The point is that two cells fuse together, forming an original cell called the zygote. We all know that. Then that zygote divides into two, then four, then eight, then 16, and so on and so forth. Pretty soon, exponential growth kicks in. But in addition to that exponential growth, certain cells decide, there's no other way to say it, decide to differentiate, meaning that they will be performing functions different than other cells. Eventually, we will have a complete organism that will display an exquisite division of labor between their cell types, organs, and organ systems. This is actually a very good moment to try to illustrate the complexity of biology using big numbers. Remember the original cell, the zygote. It divides into 2, 4, 8, 16, and so on and so forth. And let's suppose that you decide to observe a typical human, a magnificent specimen of the human species, say, a certain bald scientist of your acquaintance. Anyway, a typical human like me has between 37 and 40 trillion, with a T as in tummy, cells. 37 to 40 trillion cells. That's a lot of cells. Just imagine how many cells are in an elephant, in a blue whale, in a redwood. Okay? So, there's a lot of cells out there. And since we're talking about cells, it's time to define the cell as the fundamental unit of life. You see, a cell is the minimum ensemble, the compendium, of chemical entities that, when worked together in some way as yet undetermined, generate the phenomenon of life. And even though we define a cell in light of what life is, we still don't know what life is, okay? Essentially, life doesn't seem to be a thing, but rather a process. In this sense, there's a quite beautiful expression of this idea of life as a process rather than a thing, which also conveys the elusive nature of life. This comes from the Origins of Life researcher J.W. Schaff, and it goes like this. Just as the colors of a rainbow merge imperceptibly one into another, the transition to life from non-life is a seamless continuum. And let's explain this idea in a more prosaic way. No molecule in your bodies or mind is alive, not even a little. The hemoglobin molecules that are traveling very fast through your bloodstream, the collagen molecules that are supporting your ligaments, the ATP molecules that power up all your biochemical reactions, they are not alive, not even a little. And yet, the ensemble, as we saw before, the ensemble, the compendium of all of those molecules working together can generate a cell, which is a fundamental unit of life. It follows that the frontier of life and non-life must lie between the realm of molecules and the realm of cells. Makes sense, right? But nobody, and I mean nobody, knows where the frontier is. So, even though we don't know exactly where the frontier between life and non-life is, we know quite a bit of the kind of things that life does and what it's composed of. We know that biological life, it's kind of controlled by four key concepts: chemistry, evolution, energy transfer, and information transfer. So, that being said, please remember that we only know of one example of biological life. We don't know if ours is the only way to make life, since we cannot come with a universal definition of life yet, okay? That said, the biological life that we know and love, life on Earth, the only example that we know of, displays five common features that are shared by every living thing in our planet, from the tiniest bacterium to the biggest whale. Those five commonalities are: number one, biological life is carbon-based. Carbon seems to be the only chemical element that is versatile enough to come up with the gazillions of different types of structures that are required to make biological life. The second commonality is that every single type of life uses adenosine triphosphate, or ATP, as their biochemical source of energy. There are other bioenergetically relevant molecules, but ATP is the one that is used by everything. Number three, biological life in our planet is DNA-based. The oxyribonucleic acid is the macromolecule that encodes the genetic information in every living organism that we care to examine in our planet. Number four, the organelle that is able to extract the information encoded in DNA and put it to work, as it were, is the ribosome. All ribosomes in biological life are very similar to each other, with very subtle differences. But again, wherever there's life, there's ribosomes to put the information in DNA to work. And finally, Number 5, which we have seen before. Biological life in our planet is cell-based. The cell is the fundamental unit of life. Any single living organism that we have ever examined has at least one cell. And now, some words from our friends at Anchor. Let's go back to our episode. One important and rather beautiful detail about biological life, if you ask me, it's that we are stardust. Anything alive right now, any organism that has ever been alive, and surely this is something that we can actually say categorically, any type of life elsewhere in the universe is stardust. You see, at the moment of the Big Bang, 14.8 billion years ago, only two chemical elements were generated. Most of it was hydrogen, a little bit of helium, and maybe traces of other elements, certainly nothing heavy. The heavy elements that we need to generate biological life as we know it, we're talking about carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, and every other element heavier than hydrogen or helium, could only be formed at the very core of stars. To make a long story short, here's what happens. Stars use the process of nuclear fusion to generate their energies that they emit. In the process, helped by the gravitational field of the star, lighter atomic nuclei fuse with each other to generate the heavier atomic nuclei. So any other atom heavier than helium, it's formed at the core of stars. The process keeps going on until we get to iron, not further than iron. And in stars of a certain size, the process builds up in such a way that the stars blow up. And when that happens, we have a supernova. And when a supernova blows up, it distributes heavier elements throughout the universe. Astronomers estimate that between 4 and 5 generations of stars have to live and die in such a way to generate enough raw materials to make a solar system just like ours. If there's a listener out there who's an astronomer or a physicist and finds that I made a horrible mistake in this description, please let me know so I can correct it in a future episode. But at any rate, the main point is that we are stardust. And as I remarked before, any other living thing that we may find in the universe will come from stardust as well. But it's time to move on. We have already established that to define life is next to impossible at the current state of knowledge. However, we can actually describe life very well in terms of what it does. In other words, how can we tell whether something is alive? And I will use a comparison that has proven useful in my actual lectures when I teach students these concepts. Let's imagine that you're a journalist and you're tasked with the mission to describe what life does. So, as in any journalistic endeavor, there are several questions that you must answer in order to figure out what you're looking for. These questions are the who, the what, the when, the where, the why, and the how. So, if you want to apply these questions in order to describe biological life, we must say something right off the bat. The who and the why questions are way beyond the scope of the current understanding of science. That leaves us with the other questions that we talked about before. So, what is life? We already said that we cannot define it, but there's every indication that biological life is a natural consequence of the physical-chemical laws of our universe. The next question is, when? When did life appear on Earth? This is a very interesting question because it seems to be that life appeared in our planet as soon as it could. What I mean by that is that there's fossil evidence that seem to indicate that life in our planet was already relatively complex a short time, a matter of thousands of years, after the process of planetary formation ended. You see, when a planet forms, This sounds like when a mommy and a daddy love each other very much, but I digress. When a planet forms, remember that the cloud of gas that eventually formed the solar system had local gravity pockets that allowed for the condensation of matter, forming our sun and the planets. When the planets form, especially the rocky planets, we're talking about Mercury, Venus, our Earth, and Mars. And by the way, Venus was in the news the day I'm recording this because of the apparent discovery of a type of gas that it's formed almost exclusively by biological life. But that's something that we hope to touch upon in a future episode of this podcast as soon as we have more information on the matter. Going back to the process of planetary formation, all the small meteorites, all those rocky fragments, are joined together by gravity. And as they get together, forming a planet, they heat up. So, the beginning of the story of any rocky planet, it's going to be a molten ball of lava. Pretty much nothing can live on something like that. But the thing about it is that as the planet cooled down, and we're talking about the Earth right now, it seems to be that pretty soon, and we're talking about thousands of years, after the planet cooled down enough, life was able to appear. But we don't know the details yet. Something is for sure, these are exciting times in astrobiology. Now, the next journalistic question about what is life, it's where did life appear, for the first time at least. As far as we know, only on Earth. But we don't know for sure. That's the interesting and at the same time very frustrating reality. We don't know if there's life elsewhere in the universe. Just by statistics, just by the sheer number of stars and planets out there, is a virtual certainty. But we haven't found anything for sure as of today. Now, the last journalistic question about the topic, it's very much related to the frustration that I expressed before. Meaning, how did life appear on Earth? That's the proverbial $64,000 question. This is an old reference. Look it up. The point is that we don't know. There's a lot of hypotheses and whole theories about how inanimate matter generates animated matter. In other words, life. Perhaps one of the most interesting ideas in terms of how life is generated from non-life is the concept of emergent properties. Let's define first what an emergent property is. In a nutshell, I'm not going to give you a true formal definition, but in a nutshell, it's when multiple, and I mean millions upon gazillions of units interact with each other in such a way that new emergent properties, if you will, appear. Properties that could not be predicted by just simulating the interaction of individual particles. Let me give you an example of an emergent property using a condiment. Yep. Let's think about table salt. Sodium chloride. Sodium chloride is a compound that can be consumed by humans, right? And if you consume it in moderate amounts, it's perfectly safe. That compound, it's made out of two different elements, sodium and chlorine. Now, here's the thing. Metallic sodium, pure sodium, displays a very interesting property. When you mix it with water, it generates a literal explosive reaction, meaning that it's going to generate hydrogen gas, which due to the heat of the reaction ignites. So you mix metallic sodium with water, it goes boom.
Do not try this at home.
Then there's the case of chlorine. Chlorine, it's a gas that has a dubious distinction in the history of science. It was one of the very first, I think it was the first, but I'm not entirely sure, chemical substances used in warfare. It's a toxin, a very bad one at that.
And definitely never ever sniff chlorine gas.
Now, riddle me something. Who in their right mind will say,
ha ha ha, let's take this explosive metal, mix it with a poisonous gas, and put it in soup?
The point is that the properties of the compound formed by sodium and chlorine displays chemical properties, physical chemical properties, very different from the individual components. Many scientists think that life is a manifestation of an emergent property of when an unimaginable number of molecules interact with each other in a rather specific way, generating the phenomenon of life. And again, the most frustrating thing about this business is that we don't know exactly how that happens. Now, this brings us to the end of this section of the episode, but before we go, let's answer a listener question. This one is from Caroline A. Thank you very much for sending me the question. And it says, viruses, so close to the classification of living things, but not quite alive. Why? Well, Caroline, this is a very relevant question, especially in light of the current reality of the pandemic. The thing about viruses is that they are little more than genetic material surrounded by a coat of protein. Certain viruses have, in addition to the protein, a membrane that shares certain similarities with cell membranes. But the thing about viruses is that they do not have any other type of organelles, and they cannot live independent lives. Each type of virus has to steal the ability of a cell to make the proteins that it needs to survive. That being said, viruses, by virtue of having genetic material, they are capable of evolution, they are capable of adapting to different hosts, and display many lifelike properties. But precisely because they need a cell for them to function, they are not quite considered alive. And to all my friends in the Twitterverse, I have a very special favor to ask. Please, pretty please, don't make a Twitter fight over this. And with this remark, let's move on to the next section. Are concepts like evolution and gravitation theories or facts? The confusion between the ideas of theories and facts as applied to scientific concepts arises from the confusion between what's a theory in the colloquial sense and what's a theory in the scientific sense. For example, when we use the word theory in a colloquial, everyday sense, what we are really talking about is, strictly speaking, a hypothesis. When you're watching a police show and you think or believe that the bald guy did it, okay, that's a hypothesis. That's not your theory. On the other hand, a scientific theory is an overarching explanation that it's widely accepted as real, as true. But not just because we believe it's true. You see, a scientific theory is supported by a great deal of evidence. And contrary to common belief, you can never prove a scientific theory with 100% certainty. What you can get is information that can support your theory, okay? Things like gravitation and evolution as theories are supported by an overwhelming body of evidence in order to be accepted by the scientific community. On the other hand, any theory can be disproven or even modified with additional evidence. And in fact, this happens all the time. Let's begin by giving you the example of gravitation. Well, it is a known fact that if you jump, you will fall, right? That happens anywhere and everywhere on Earth, okay? The speed of your fall and how hard you will hit the ground will depend on how high are you jumping from and on your weight, which can vary from planet to planet. You see, your mass is the amount of matter that you possess. Your weight, on the other hand, is a function of your mass plus the gravitational attraction of a certain planetary body. Okay? In this example, we are using weight and mass interchangeably because we're not leaving the planet. I hope you agree with me that in this context, gravitation, it's a fact. Okay? Remember, you jump, I jump, we both fall. Agreed? I just realized that I sound like I'm saying the Titanic lines, but never mind. Moving on. In contrast, ever since people began to think in scientific terms, even if they didn't know they were doing science, there's been several theories of gravitation over the millennia. The ancient Greeks had their idea of the mechanism that make things fall when they were dropped. Then, in the 1600s, a gentleman called Isaac Newton came up with a mathematical theory of gravitation, which was in fact the very first time that gravitation was explained in mathematical terms. All right? Incidentally, Isaac Newton is also very well known for the following fact. When he was at the university, there was a pandemic, and they sent all the students home, which was the absolutely right thing to do in the 1600s as well as right now. And please don't send me a message or anything. My own university, I'm very proud to say, did exactly that. But I digress. The point is that while Newton was home, he wasn't taking classes, he wasn't, you know, really doing anything at all. To literally entertain himself, he invented integral calculus. And here I am suffering from writer's block. Go figure. By the way, Newton kind of co-invented calculus alongside Leibniz, a German philosopher, but that's a story for some other time. So, from the 1600s until the beginning of the 20th century, Newton was the man in terms of explaining gravitation. Then, in the early 20th century, Einstein came along, and I shouldn't have to tell you who Einstein was. He came up with yet another theory of gravitation that complemented and refined Newton's insights, all right? But here's my point. Let's suppose that you're, you know, minding your own business, walking along and whatever, and you trip and fall. You know what? For the sake of comedy, let's make it like you slipped on a banana peel, okay? Well, I guarantee that as you fall to the ground, you are not thinking,
oh, how would the ancient Greeks explain my fall?
You would neither think.
Which ones of Newton's equations apply to my fall?
And I'm pretty sure that you will neither think,
oh, I'm falling down the gravity well of the space-time continuum of the Earth.
You'll say none of those three things. I guarantee it. You will go like, holy sh**. I've told you before, I have the humor of a six-year-old. So now you know how gravitation can be at the same time a theory or theories and a fact, right? The same thing applies to biological evolution. There is one undeniable reality. There are forms of life that existed 60 million years ago that are not around right now. And there will be forms of life that will exist 10,000 years in the future, a million years in the future, that are not around right now. Life has changed over time. That is literal evolution. That's the fact of evolution. Another matter is the theories that have tried to account for that evolutionary change. Natural selection is one of the best ones, but even now we know that it's not the only game in town. A discussion of the current evolutionary theories and ideas about that will take way longer than a podcast episode. We may talk about that in the future, but you surely get the idea. Both evolution and gravitation, as well as many other things, science-wise, can be considered theories and facts, depending on the context. Well, all right. Before we move on to the last topic of the podcast, it's time to answer a listener question. This one comes from Eloisa. And it goes like this. Hi, Professor One. I love it. Thank you, Eloisa. I really enjoy all your content, and I'm a new fan of yours. So, my question for your episode numero dos is, do you think we, as Homo sapiens sapiens, will go extinct, or will we evolve? Well, Eloisa, before I answer your question, I want to thank you for your kind words. Really, it warms my heart that you think of me like that, and I really appreciate it. Your question is very interesting and very relevant, since we humans are not exempt from the realities of evolution. However, this is a classical question whose answer is not clear-cut, or even what we'd like to hear. In other words, in the parlance of social media, it's complicated. So, what do you want first, the good news or the bad news? The good news is that, yes, we are going to likely keep evolving. The bad news is that, yes, we will probably go extinct at some point. That seems to be the fate of all species, at least as far as we know. In fact, that's how species are generated. One species becomes extinct by evolving into another one. This is, of course, an oversimplification. It is much more complex than that, but you surely get what I'm trying to say. That being said, in our case, it's a little more complicated than that because in addition of being subject to the laws and rules of evolutionary change, we have at our disposal two very important factors that can bend or even change such rules. In other words, they can be game changers. The first one is that we have the type of intelligence that leads to technology. Okay, that's the very first one. That's part of the reason why we are what we are in our planet right now. The second part is that we have learned, in most cases at least, to cooperate with each other in order to reach a common goal. Of course, we are not the only species that cooperates with members of its own species. However, again, we are the only technological one so far. And those two factors, technological intelligence and cooperation, are the key of our success, the combination of both traits. You see, one-on-one, no matter how smart a human is, he or she is no match for a saber-toothed tiger. It was only with the realization that we could cooperate with each other that we are again what we are today, for good, bad, or ugly. In essence, the combination of technology and cooperation enhances our phenotype. Remember that genotype is the genes, phenotype is the expression of those genes, in order to increase our chances of survival. And so far, it has worked. It gets worse or better, depending on your point of view, because we have discovered and developed molecular biology techniques that can help us guide our own evolution. We don't know where this is going to lead us. Again, for good, bad, or ugly. There are a lot of challenges in this regard, and let's just hope that our humanity, the things that makes us, well, good, develops at the same pace as our technology. I hope I was able to answer your question, Eloise, and again, thank you. All right, so let's move on to the last topic that we are going to discuss today. Does science even exist? Aren't I a stinker? I have to confess that I chose this topic to finish today's episode for two reasons. The first one is that the phrase is intriguing, and it's a little teaser, if you will. Second, this is precisely how I began my very first book, The First Brain, The Neuroscience of Planarians, and you know that I had to mention planarians in this episode. Anyway, the very first sentence of the book is, science does not exist. It was, of course, a very strange way to begin a science book by a science professor, a person who unapologetically loves science. And of course, I didn't mean it literally. Science, of course, does exist, but not in exactly the way you may think. Just like life, science is not a thing. It's a process, a human process that allows us to divide nature into manageable chunks to try to understand it better. You see, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, it was possible for a single person to learn everything that there was to learn about science or about nature. That's not the case anymore. By necessity, people have to specialize, but paradoxically, the boundaries between sciences are disappearing. 200 years ago, it was very possible to understand biology without ever bothering to learn about chemistry, and that's simply not the case anymore. It is impossible to understand biology without an understanding of chemistry, physics, and even mathematics. That's the reality. But there's a deeper, way deeper reason for me to state that science does not exist. Let's take, for example, any organism of our choice. Let's choose right now the peregrine falcon. It is a bird, a raptor, that can fly at a maximum speed of about 240 miles per hour. We can study a falcon in terms of biomechanics. We can think about how it generates the ATP necessary for those muscles to actually contract in such a way to generate that speed. We can actually talk about the further biochemistry that it's necessary for the visual acuity that these organisms must display in order to hunt. We can examine with a high degree of admiration the exquisite coordination of its nervous system that it's necessary to actually control all its bodily systems in an integrated way in order to do what it does. But do you think that the bird cares? It just exists. And the only way that we can actually understand it in a more coherent way, it's through the methods of science to divide the multiple functions of that particular organism into different disciplines in order to understand its majestic biology. In this episode, we began our journey with the concepts of science and wonder. And I have to confess that there was only a single topic in this episode. Science is not incompatible with wonder. Science does not eliminate wonder. If anything, the absolute opposite is true. It's only through science, technology, and mathematics that we can understand the universe in a more realistic way. The more we learn, the more we tease nature's secrets, the better we will understand, the more we will understand how truly majestic our universe is. Well, my dear friends, I don't know about you, but I had a lot of fun recording this episode. Once again, I thank you for listening to me. And I want to specially acknowledge my friend Loani, who has become my mentor in the art of broadcasting. Thank you, Loani. In the next episode of the Bold Scientist Podcast, so, you want to write popular science? Please join me next time to talk about it. I will tell you about my journey writing popular science. Maybe the things that work for me will work for you. At any rate, we're going to talk about it and see where it leads us. Once again, this is One, your host, your ear candy, and your unapologetic science nerd in this, your Bold Scientist Podcast. Please remember to stay out of trouble, and as you already know, I never do. Take care. Bye-bye. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of my employer, my wife, my children, my parents and siblings, or Chuck Darwin.